that's something that gets thrown around all over the place. Everyone seems to be burnt out these days. What if it's not burnout? What if it's something else? My guest on the Reset podcast today is Mark Butler. He's a clinical psychologist, and he actually helps people work out what's going on, how to get curious about what's happening and what to do about it. And we're going to look at things like burnout. We're going to look at things of what else it might be. It might be bore out. It might be vicarious trauma. It might be something else. And Mark's going to give you some really cool insights and some really good ways to get curious about what's going on with your world. If you think you're burned out, have a listen to Mark Butler. Mark Butler, what would you like to reset?
I think, Luke, in my experience, I'd like to reset how we approach burnout in the workplace, because I think it's become a catch-all phrase for every mental health challenge that we experience. And that's actually not the case. There can be a lot more going on. So I think we could reset there.
Okay. So if we're using, because it is sort of ubiquitous, isn't it? It's burnout is kind of everywhere, and people are getting the blame for everything.
Yeah.
You know, you're a clinical psychologist. So can you tell us a little bit about how that works and what are the other things that it could possibly be if it's not burnout?
Sure. What we're seeing is a level of overwhelm that people are experiencing, and that's what's kind of causing folks to call it burnout. You're right. It is a ubiquitous term now, and it's the catch-all phrase for everything. But there are a great many sectors where we are seeing differing levels of a sort of mental sort of strain, if you like. Issues that used to be sort of particular, we'll say, to first responders, police, fire, ambulance, etc. And even sort of veterans to a degree as well. Issues like vicarious trauma, which we see in the healthcare sector quite a bit. And that is kind of swimming in a thick soup of other people's trauma, right? If you're getting stories and messages, and I experienced this when I worked in the recovery sort of sector at one point in time. What I found was when you're hearing people's horror stories over and over, or you're and differing versions of the same thing from various people, it can kind of wear you down a little bit. So vicarious trauma is a very, very common issue in the healthcare sector. But we're also now seeing it in areas like journalism, as an example, is a very particular one. Where, you know, there are something like 1 in 6 people in the world has had experience of some kind of political turmoil this year. And journalists are off reporting and all that. That's an astonishing number. 1 in 6 in the last 12 months. And so journalists...
For those that don't know, can you explain a little bit about what vicarious trauma is?
Sure. It's kind of prolonged exposure to other people's traumatic stories or experiences. So you're taking on other people's trauma. And as I was saying, for me working in the addiction space, addiction is always the result of other people's trauma, right? And so you were always hearing other people's kind of stories around what led them to the sort of to where they are today.
Yeah.
And it's always been overwhelming trauma, usually childhood related, but not always. But what it meant is that there's a sort of a gradual, slow building level of sort of exhaustion from dealing with other people's trauma and their anguish and trying to support them through that. That can be very, very exhausting over a long period of time.
So if we're looking at, you know, one of the treatments for burnout, a lot of them are kind of more self-care and decreasing your workload,
yeah,
and a lot of that sort of stuff. How would that differ from treating someone, from a psychologist's point of view, treating someone with vicarious trauma? How would you treat those two differently?
Yeah, well, burnout particularly, and let's just assume it's work-related burnout. It might not be. There are other areas where we can burn out in our lives, like caring for special needs kids or parents, aging parents, etc., taking on too much in our lives. The self-care strategy around dealing with our burnout is going to be quite different to the sorts of training that people need around trauma in an area like vicarious trauma. We need sort of team support and external support and resilience building. A lot of psychoeducation is required, stuff that doesn't actually happen for people who are experiencing burnout. You know, very often we hear this idea, if you're burning out, just take a break. Yeah, sometimes. You know, Gordon Parker talks about the flickering candle versus the extinguished candle. How you deal with a flickering candle is you nurse the flame until it comes back.
Yeah.
An extinguished candle, you either have to decide, do I light this candle again or do I get another candle? Yeah, you know what I mean?
What a beautiful metaphor for it.
Isn't it lovely looking at it? So is my candle burned out? Is it flickering or is it blown out? And how I respond to that's going to be very, very different. But it's going to be a self-care strategy, particularly if it's in that sort of burnout space. But something like vicarious trauma, which we see in nurses and medical staff all the time, is a very, very different, it needs a different approach. Burnout means I'm sort of disconnected and disengaged from everything in my life. You know, I'm not thinking clearly. I've lost that sort of, I've become cynical and I've lost that.
My head's up my ass. I'm just not.
Yeah, basically my head's up my ass. Exactly right. Whereas with vicarious trauma, you can be absolutely on sort of target and on the ball with everything else in your sort of work. But like compassion fatigue or vicarious trauma, you just become numb to certain sort of elements of it.
I had a real penny moment that there are some things, you know, with burnout, you really want to be able to have a break. You really want to be able to calm down, have a break, being able to sort of fill your bucket. With other things, if it's something like you might have a phobia or a fear of something. Say you've got a real fear of talking to your boss, and that's renting a room in your head and that's ruminating around there, and that's part of the reason why your bucket's always full. Yeah. Having a break from that's probably not going to help. Talking to your boss and actually having a difficult conversation is going to be a way better strategy. Like if you're scared of spiders, you've got to have some exposure therapy to spiders to be able to get over that fear, or a fear of flying.
Yeah.
We can't just go and sing Kumbaya and, you know, have a meditation and all of a sudden that fear's gone.
No, exactly right.
So how do you go about helping people do that and working out, almost diagnosing well enough to then be able to work out, well, what's going to be the best strategy for this person?
In terms of the workplace, I think what you're talking there about taps into this idea of psychological safety, you know. And now there are a number of different sort of phrases that are doing the rounds in workplaces today. We have new legislation that talks about psychosocial hazards and sort of psychosocial safety and well-being in the workplace. That's kind of cobbling towards psych and social. So in other words, what it's talking about is the mental health strain someone experiences as a result of their workplace. And in a sense, what you're talking about could tap into that for somebody. In reality, what's going on for them, it's a sort of a heightened anxiety that they have because they feel unsafe. And so, psychological safety means you can have a differing opinion. You can have a diverse kind of response in the workplace. And sometimes that's encouraged in order to create innovative thoughts, to challenge a marketing campaign that you think is not going to be successful, et cetera. Having the ability to have those sorts of conversations in the workplace, you need to know that you're not going to be blamed for having a differing opinion. And so when you're talking about someone who's afraid to go speak to their boss, I'm concerned that that's not a psychologically safe environment. It might not be psychosocially challenged, but in terms of psychological safety, being able to bring bad news to the boss, being able to have a differing opinion and not be worried about sort of being blamed. So play the ball, not the player, if you like.
Does that then put the onus on the boss to make sure that they're having those conversations and they're instigating and they're making that person know that they are safe to make a mistake and to bring up problems? And if I'm doing something that's really bothering you, I need you to tell me?
Yeah.
Is that what it's coming down to?
Any leader worth their salt should be creating that sort of an environment and certainly not making it unsafe for people to sort of not feel like they can come forward, you know. I'd love to live in a world where I thought every leader had that sort of mindset, you know, that my people can come and speak to me about whatever is going on for them. 75% of leaders think that that's true, but only about 35% of employees believe it to be true. So that's a leader thinks they're
putting that out there, but what they're putting out there is not how it's received.
Very, very much so. Or there's an assumption. My people know they can come to talk to me about anything, anytime. Yeah. You know, maybe they can't. Or sometimes
they can come and talk to me anywhere, anytime, but I'm going to chew their head off if they make a mistake, and I'm going to throw the toys out of the pram and yell and scream and make them feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah. So yeah. Or call them an idiot if they've made a mistake or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And actually, you know, the flip side of that can actually be a challenge as well. During COVID and lockdowns, et cetera, we had the whole conversation about mental health sort of came to the rose to the top. And, you know, if there's any silver lining out of all of that, you know, we go for beers on a Friday, or we have Zoom meetings on a Wednesday, and I'm very close to my people. They know they can come to me at any time. That can actually be a red flag, because if a leader assumes people can come and see them at any time, if they're that close and they're that sort of intertwined, the people won't likely come to them when they're experiencing some kind of challenge, because they don't want to let the boss down. You know, we're so close knit and we work so well together. If I sort of show some kind of weakness, I'm going to be letting the side down. Boss is going to think less of me. You know, the boss thinks that they're creating this really family environment, but in actual fact, what's actually occurring here is the creation of an unsafe environment. It's not safe to not be well.
I remember, you know, I remember moving businesses at one stage, and I asked one of my staff members. I had a couple of them came with me. I asked one of the other staff members, "Would you like to come as well?" And she actually said no. And I was a bit taken aback with it. And I'm kind of went, okay, well, that's fine. I thought we had a really good relationship and all that sort of stuff. And I spoke to her a few years later, and she said, I wish I had have come with you, because the other people I didn't get on with so well. And I said, well, why didn't you? And she said, I knew I wasn't at my best at the moment because I had a lot going on in my world and I didn't want to let you down.
Wow.
Mm. And I was just like, oh, wow. You know, you wouldn't have let me down. We would have supported you through it and you would have been okay. So that goes to exactly what you're saying, isn't it? That
we can be too close, you know?
Yeah, right.
We really can. And
so how do you address that in a workplace situation? Is it a vulnerability from the boss to be able to say, look, I'm not perfect either? Or how do we deal with that?
I think it has to come from the top down, and it has to be, even if a leader can sort of share a sense of vulnerability about themselves, they still need to address this point and say, if you're struggling, please come to me. I would much rather support you in the early stages than have to deal with, you know, have to deal with something that's gone on too long that we could have addressed sooner. Of course, being vulnerable and having the conversation by, you know, if it's somebody's anxiety is through the roof around their experience of anxiety, it might not be themselves, but they might have a kid who's anxious, they might have a partner who's anxious, and sort of having the conversation with their people saying, you know, sometimes the workload here is so much, we can become very, very anxious, and I'm the same. And just creating the normalizing the conversation so that people can come forward if they feel they need to.
Particularly as a leader, you know, most times I think it's really important leaders turn up really consistently each time. And if you know you're not, say your child's sick, or, you know, my dog just died or something like that, to be able to sort of say, look, I'm probably not going to be at my best today. Can you please bear with me a little bit? I don't want to talk about it now because whatever's going on. If I'm not at my best today, can you please forgive me, and, you know, I'll try and, you know, be better tomorrow, to be able to say those sorts of conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And even a leader can actually be in that position to say that as well. We're all human, and I think you can. And if your people understand that you're sort of at that level, then it's going to be a much easier conversation for them to be able to say it. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. But I think it just turns into all of this psychological safety stuff. The leader has to kind of, I don't know, put on their mask before helping someone else. I know that cliche is that metaphors are overused to buggery, but it's still really, really valid and really true.
I think it is, but we are all human, you know. And the interesting thing about, we're back to burnout for just a second. The interesting thing with burnout is you're not as likely to see it in yourself. Other people will see it in you before you see it in yourself.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is you or I would kind of, our self-critic won't allow us to admit that that's what's going on for us. So we'll make a load of excuses for ourselves as to why we're feeling the way we're feeling.
Yeah.
And it's usually not until somebody points out to us to say that their behavior has shifted.
And you come back and you're not burnt out anymore, you can kind of go, well, geez, I was a bit fried the last few weeks.
Have I been bad tempered in the last few weeks? You know, it's going to take a psychologically safe place for somebody to go, yeah, you were actually.
I think I've been an asshole the last couple of weeks. Remember that time, Joanne, when I snapped at you for this? I'm really sorry about that. Can you call me on it if I do that next time?
Yeah.
Sometimes when my bucket gets full, I can't deal with this stuff quite as well as I'd like to.
Yeah.
Can we go back to, you know, we know burnout is overload, you know, not enough time for the amount of work you got to do, constant things coming at you, not being able to take breaks and stuff.
Yeah.
What are some of the other things that can sort of fill your bucket that you actually have to treat a little bit differently? Something like a maybe moral distress or a moral injury or some of those other things that...
Yeah, well, moral injury or moral distress is a very, very interesting topic. Traditionally speaking, it was kind of lumped in with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in veterans and first responders. But we're starting to see it now as something that's kind of separate from that. It's more than a symptom of post-traumatic stress. So moral distress or moral injury, I suppose the best kind of definition would be kind of actions or directives or a lack of action that deeply violates your sort of your moral code or code of ethics.
So now, you're doing something that I'm not doing, this type of person that
really kind of flies in the face of all I hold dear.
No, wow. So you could see, I could see that happening in the military, being something, you know, I just shot someone who I thought was a terrorist and they were actually just a mother or I don't know. I've no history of that sort of stuff. So is that the type of thing you're thinking, that you're coming from this PTSD, that I've done something that doesn't agree with my values?
Yeah. And I've seen and spoken a lot about it with the veteran community. Like some horror stories that people are trying to sort of come to terms with. It's really, really difficult. But even, you know, we find flavors of it. It can be acute sort of following a specific event, or it can be gradual, accumulating over time. And we're starting to see it with younger generations now around sort of sustainability and climate sort of challenges that we're experiencing. So if you're, you know, you're working for a local government organization and you're in a regional town and it's the biggest employer in the town, but the council is doing things that kind of fly in the face of your sort of ethical guidelines, if you like, or your own sort of ethical...
I'm having to execute policies that I don't necessarily believe in, that sort of stuff.
We're tearing down this forest to build a new housing estate, and that flies in the face of everything I hold dear. Or sometimes could be people working in big tobacco, or people working in online gambling organizations.
The Stoics and that, with like Epictetus, you know, waste no time on something you can't control, I think really helps in that situation. But it's a lot easier said than done, isn't it?
What
tips would you give people that are in that sort of moral injury and they're having that sort of wrestle inside their head? Because that can really rent a room up there, can't it, when you're having to do something. So what tips would you give people to help them deal with that?
Well, if they were going to try and prevent it in the workplace, there needs to be long conversations around ethics and even ethics training for the organization that you're working with. And really needs open dialogue. You absolutely have to have the psychological safety we were just talking about. And then a sort of a code of conduct guidelines, or, you know, very, 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 very common sort of conversations to have. Access to some sort of ethics committee or professional help in that sort of way. Because the recovery from it, you have to, you know, it can be long term. It can and often requires removal from the role. You know, if it flies in the face of all I hold dear and it hasn't been explained to me properly what needs to occur, I might not be able to weather the storm for too much longer. You know, it can happen in the health sector, making decisions on life or death around people, you know, that sometimes have to be made, but that would fly in the face of all that one holds dear, particularly if you have a sort of religious sort of slant towards some of the work it is that you have to do, because you end up with feelings of guilt and shame and sort of resistance to do your role, which means you're probably not going to be able to perform at your best anyway. So
about guilt and shame. One of the other things you said, it might not be burnout. And another thing that can rent a room in your head is survivor guilt.
Yes, so, very much.
Yeah. So how if you had someone and their bucket's full and they're really stressed, and I'm sorry, I keep coming back to stress because that's kind of what I do. But
you're right. That's where it lives. So yeah.
So if you've got survivor guilt, that, you know, just going and sitting on a beach for 3 days isn't going to fix survivor guilt. So your treatments for burnout aren't going to help someone with survivor guilt. So what would you do if you were, you know, if all of your friends got sacked and you didn't? Or,
yeah,
you know, all of your friends didn't got shot in an ambush in, as an army person and you survived.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, survivor guilt is even much broader than that today. When you look at the last few years we've had, we have been bouncing from droughts to floods to fires to and back to droughts again now. You know, we're working with local councils here who have seen entire sort of neighborhoods and towns disappearing, and but their house survived, but the person sitting next to them in the workplace lost everything. It can be very, very hard, particularly when you're coming up to sort of seasons and holidays like Christmas.
So how do you deal with that as a person that's experiencing that? My house is okay, but all my neighbors have burned to the ground. How do you actually, how do you deal with that?
It's very, very difficult. If it's something that is overwhelming you, it doesn't kind of go away by itself. So it needs conversation. Sometimes it might need professional sort of support or professional help to speak to somebody about it. You know, because very often when we're highly emotive like that, we start to sort of connect the emotional response to what actually occurred, which was random. You know, it's just chaos or random theory that your house survived while the other one burnt down. Yeah. And it's not because you were wearing your lucky socks. Do you know what I mean? People can start to make those sorts of connections, and they're not helpful because they need to be sort of talked away, if you want, for want of a better term. What I have found for people who experience survivor guilt is doing something benevolent above and beyond what they normally do. So it might be volunteering somewhere. It might be, you know, raising funds for people. There's things like that you can do.
It feels wonderful. I remember the recent floods we had a couple of years ago up here in Queensland, and you know, my house wasn't flooded. I was all fine, all of that sort of stuff. But we put the gumboots on and the old clothes, and we basically shoveled crap out of some random person's garage and bottom story of their house.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's a warm, fuzzy feeling of altruism you get when you do those sorts of things. And that's, you know, you think of what you do to burnout. For burnout, you go and sit down and you go and relax and you go and put your feet up. But if you've got survivorship guilt, doing what you said, doing something benevolent and going out and helping someone else is actually not resting. It's not, you know, putting your hands around your flame. Like you said, and came out of that day a big, sweaty, stinky, smelly mess. But good about being me because I'd helped someone. So is that the type of thing that we've got to have the awareness of actually what's renting a room in our head, what's going on, and then be specific about our plan of where we go forward?
Yeah, particularly when what's renting a room in your head is probably being uninvited. You know, it's not they're squatting in your head rather than renting a room, I think, half the time. But like what you're just speaking about, we lost the ground floor of our property in the floods,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, and I'll never forget, total strangers plus neighbors, but some strangers I hadn't seen before, just driving past and said, what can we do to help? And they would just get out and they'd start shoveling and they'd start scraping and washing and wiping things down. I mean, the Australian spirit is phenomenal for that.
It is amazing in those situations, isn't it?
Oh, listen,
what people will do and help.
I came to Australia 35 or more years ago, and from my accent, you could probably guess St. Patrick's Day used to be the biggest day of my year. It very quickly became Australia Day, and probably Anzac Day are bigger days for me now. I immediately experienced in my first year seeing like the SES and the volunteer fire people sort of parading on Australia Day, and just the entire town out sort of clapping and cheering them on. And I just thought, that's actually community. That's what it's all about. And yet it still happens without the accolade. People, the accolade rests uneasy on most volunteers' heads. You know, they don't like it pointed out. They just like to get on and do it. Yeah. And I just think that's the Australian spirit has been huge. And hugely figural in my life.
Because it's an amazing thing, isn't it? If that, I actually look at there's burnout. I also think there's bore out.
Oh,
I'm not motivated. I haven't done anything good. I don't feel like I'm contributing. In stress Teflon language, I have awareness, belonging, and contribution. That we've got to have those three to make stress not stick.
Yeah.
A lot of time, what happens, we're not aware of exactly why we're pissed off. We're just pissed off.
Yeah.
Right. We don't feel like we really belong in the community that we're in, and we're not really contributing. So if we're not having got awareness, belonging, and contribution, stress is going to stick to us.
Yes. Yes.
So what we're talking about there is I'm aware that, okay, I'm feeling uncomfortable. I've automatically thrown it as burnout. It could be bore out. It could be something else.
Yeah.
How can I connect with my community, and how can I actually contribute? And sometimes that might actually mean doing more, but that could actually cure the burnout.
And yes, it is a very useful sort of strategy for when somebody's experiencing burnout is to take on a passion project. You know, if you talk to teachers in the education system in schools, if someone's burnt out, they can't really change their job. You're a teacher or you're not, you know, pretty much. But very often a great strategy is to sort of say, okay, for the next term, Wednesdays, we're going to put you on a passion project of yours, and it might be creating something that's going to make a difference to kids' lives. And that can, that sort of then every Wednesday during the week, you're doing a project for the school that has you stepped out from the thing that's burning you out most of all. But it's something that you're passionate about, you're engaged into, increases your sense of belonging and your sense of contribution, like you're just talking about. Yeah. You know,
We default when we're worried about burnout. I think we default to I need to do less, and I don't think it's necessarily always the default of choice. I don't think it's actually sometimes the most helpful one. So, I guess what you're saying is more. To get curious of exactly what it is that is making you uncomfortable, find that awareness, and then to be able to work out what are my options, and then try some other actions.
But yeah,
I think the way you put it with this is that let's not jump to burnout straight away. Let's have a look and see what it is that's making me feel uncomfortable or distressed.
And it might not be burnout. Bore out is an excellent choice of language. Very often, and most of us will have, many of us will have experienced it without realizing it. You know,
I've been an optometrist for 27 years. I've asked which one's clearer, number one or number two. I've got one of the little machines behind me. And I've asked that 9.5 million times.
Yeah.
That part of that job got really boring, and I was actually feeling burnt out because I was so frustrated with having done the same thing for so long.
Yeah.
But there was something about once I noticed that I could put that little part of it in a box and then made sure I contributed to my tribe, made sure I helped other people get better and all of that sort of stuff. And then I didn't feel burnt out anymore.
Yeah.
So nothing really had to change other than how I was looking at it. And I think bore out is a really, really big part of it that we can't I think burnout gets the blame for something that we just haven't got anything that's lighting us up. And humans need shit that lights us up. It's really important.
Absolutely. That's the thing with bore out. I mean, it is actually a psychological syndrome. It is recognized as that. And if somebody who's watching this program has ever gone for a job and told they were overqualified, that's what the organization was worried about. You're not going to be challenged by this. And our line would usually be, let me be the judge of that. And the response would be, no, we'll be the judge of that, because you just disappear in a year and we will have wasted a year just trying to see if you would sort of come to like the job. you know, and sometimes if we've been in a high pressure environment, we like to kind of think, oh, you know, I just love a job plucking chickens where I can just kind of stop at the end of the day.
That's the greatest load of bullshit ever. You would get
Reality is, you know,
so many people do that. And I've done it myself. I thought, you know, I've retired twice. You know? And it's just, and you get bored out of your head. We need tribes and we need to contribute. It's massively important.
Yeah, the contribution you're talking about there is just an extension of belonging. Brené Brown talks about belonging very, very well. But
I love her distinction of there's a difference between belonging and fitting in.
Fitting in,
but there's I change so extension. That I can work in this environment. Belonging, they accept me for how I am and welcome into that environment how I am. And it's a really cool, really cool differentiation, that one. It's subtle, but it's massive.
But there's an extension to it that doesn't get spoken about as much. So it's like if you look at a spectrum, fitting in is where I sort of begin. And then, you know, when I become accustomed to it and I do feel safe and I feel I trust everyone around me, I feel like I belong. Like, you know, my first date versus now we're 6 months dating, I can be the sort of real me kind of thing.
Yeah.
But and then you're talking about contribution. There's a body of work that came out in the 50s around that whole sort of self-esteem work. And then it kind of disappeared and it came back in the 80s. And now it's disappeared, but it's starting to come back again. And it's this concept of mattering. So I matter. So in other words, like you're saying, contribution, it's more than belonging, more than just sort of knowing that I found my tribe and here I'm doing my work. When we matter, other people will rely on us for various things. They sort of see us as greater than just us. Our contribution means more than just us belonging. And people come to rely on us and what we contribute to the team or to the community.
Because I matter.
Because we matter, yeah. And it's greater than belonging. It's next step along the spectrum, if you like. It's that contribution thing you're talking about. Hugely important, because that's where our esteem comes from.
Yeah, it does. And I love Oprah Winfrey had a great quote that she interviewed 10,000 people over the time that she had the Oprah Winfrey Show. And she said the one thing that all of them had in common was they all had a need for validation. They all had a need for wanting to feel seen, to mattering, to use your language.
Yeah, just use a need to be needed.
And we all need to be needed. So I actually think from what you're saying is that burnout's just turned into that's the bucket we throw everything in when we're uncomfortable or unhappy about something.
Yeah.
And I guess to my parlance, we've got to get curious as to what that is. And how do we change that?
It might not be burnout. It might be, but it might not be. And if we try and treat everything with the same sort of diagnosis and the same treatment, we could miss entirely what people are trying to deal with, you know, and sort of give the wrong treatment for what's going on for them, if you like, or the wrong approach. And the problem is, of course, I'm talking about things like secondary traumatic stress, compassion fatigue, vicarious trauma. Certain industries recognize the language, but there are new industries that are experiencing it now, and they won't know what, you know, they won't know. They know something's wrong. It's a bit like that. What's that phrase? I don't know art, but I know what I like. It's kind of reminiscent of that. Something's going on for me. We're saying it's burnout, but that doesn't seem to be getting it. That doesn't seem to be doing it for me. Or we're looking at teams that used to perform superbly well a year ago, and they're just not performing now. And our assumption is that there's somebody wrong in the team or the leader's getting it wrong. There's any one of these sorts of issues could be going on for your team. There could be, you know, it's an NDIS problem. It's a local government problem. It's an insurance and loss adjusters problem. It's a journalist's problem. It's an environmental protection agency type problem. It's courts. It's child protection. It's public guardianship. All of those roles now are experiencing this sense of overwhelm, and we're saying it's burnout. Is it? You know, we don't know. Until
maybe it's not. I guess that's where we need to get curious and actually have a look and see what's going on in our own heads and be able to work out. I love the idea of catch, wait, and reset. The idea that I'm feeling uncomfortable. What am I thinking is wait and then reset. What can I control? What are my alternatives? What do I need to delete? And just that three-step process for me helps perfectly well. But it's great to talk to someone who's a clinician and has all the letters. Mark's got more letters after his name than anyone I know, and he looks after people in a lot of workplaces with this. So if people wanted to get you to come into their workplace and help them become more psychologically safe and maybe, you know, find strategies for people who think it's burnout, but it might be something else, how would they get in contact with you, Mark?
Jump on my website, mark@markbutler.com.au. My email, just mark@markbutler. Yeah, my website, markbutler.com.au. My number is 0412-618-648. At a 6-1, if somebody's watching from overseas. I work with organizations globally now. And just like you're saying, you know, if we can start a conversation, and sometimes you need Switzerland in the room to be able to sort of start that and you know, sort of ensure that everybody feels safe to sort of share what's going on for them. Until you're actually talking about what it is, you're not going to figure out what it is. That's what I do. I've been doing it forever.
I think if anyone does have some of these issues and they're really struggling with burnout, I think working out whether it is burnout or not is a really important gig, and that's one of the things I can help you with. But, mate, it's always good to chat to you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Luke.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, mate. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you inviting me. Thanks very much, mate.